I want you to take a second and just picture your childhood home.
Oh, yeah, like the exact image of the front of the house.
Right, the shape of the driveway, the street it was on. Just really put yourself there. For most of us, we tend to think of that space as, I don't know, an impregnable fortress.
Right. It was the place where you were perfectly safe.
Exactly, the ultimate sanctuary where all the chaos of the outside world simply couldn't reach you.
The walls kept everything bad out.
Yeah, but what happens when an artist paints that exact quote-unquote safe childhood refuge, and instead of warmth, we look at the canvas and we see, well, invisible trenches?
Wow, yeah, invisible trenches. That changes the whole feeling.
It really does. Today, we are looking at a watercolor that does exactly that. It's a piece called Homes in Paulo VI by the Colombian artist Jairo Duque.
And we're going to unpack exactly how the heavy, violent history of the 1980s shaped this specific artwork.
Right, so welcome to this deep dive. Our mission today is to explore this literal collision between fragile personal nostalgia and massive collective historical trauma.
We are essentially exploring how external history quietly rewrites our internal sense of self.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the context surrounding the creation of this painting is a massive contradiction.
It really is a wild geographical and temporal leap.
Yeah, I mean, Duke actually painted this watercolor very recently, right? In February of 2023.
In his studio in Whittier, California.
Right, which is this sun-drenched, quiet, stable space where he normally works. And then it was later exhibited at the Art Boxy Art Expo Basel in Miami.
So we have 2023 California, Miami. Very sunny, very safe.
Exactly. But the soul of the painting drags you decades backward in time and thousands of miles south.
It takes us straight into the Paulo VI neighborhood in Bogota, Colombia, during the 1980s.
Right. And for anyone who didn't live through it, the term 1980s Colombia might just sound like, I don't know, a generic historical
It's
backdrop.
just a setting in a movie or something.
Yeah, exactly. But it was a tremendously heavy social and political climate.
It really was. The Paulo VI neighborhood was actually designed as an emblematic middle-class sector.
Oh, really? Like a typical suburb.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a standard, peaceful suburban ideal. But the reality of that decade was characterized by a latent, buzzing violence.
We are talking about an era defined by political instability and cartel
And the
clashes.
violence wasn't always a massive explosion, you know. More often, it was the heavy silence before one.
That tension.
Exactly. It was an atmosphere that defined how you breathed, how you walked, and how you lived.
So, I mean, the central question we are tackling today, the core debate in the sources, is how to actually read this artwork.
How do we interpret it?
Right. When we look at Homes in Paulo VI, are we looking at a psychological, intimate landscape?
Like, is this just a painting about youthful alienation?
Yeah, about how a teenager feels disconnected from the world and about the sheer fragility of memory. Or, on the flip side, is it a direct socio-political document?
A tactical portrait of a society completely paralyzed by historical fear. It's the classic tension between the microhistory of the individual and the macro history of a nation.
And Duke explicitly states in the materials that he is not trying to reconstruct the neighborhood as it objectively was.
Right. This is not an architectural blueprint of Bogota.
No, not at all. He says he paints the neighborhood as it was fixed in his memory.
Which means it's fragmented, it's silent, it's slightly unreal.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is that aligns perfectly with how human memory, especially memory formed under intense stress, physically encodes in the brain.
Because we don't remember things like a perfect movie, right?
Exactly. We don't record continuous high-definition video of our lives. When a brain is operating in an environment of latent threat, it just drops the unnecessary data.
It filters out the noise to focus on survival.
Right. It doesn't hold on to the specific architectural dimensions of a street corner or the exact color of a brick. Instead, the emotional core of the scene burns in permanently.
So the spatial awareness fragments.
And what gets preserved is the raw feeling of isolation and vulnerability.
Okay, but I have to push back on classifying this strictly as a document dictated by trauma, though.
Why is that?
Well, the sources specifically warn us that this isn't an idealized warm nostalgia. Duke deliberately empties the neighborhood of specific details, making it incredibly austere.
Very bare.
Yeah. But if we accept this as an empty mental landscape designed specifically so that you and I, the viewers, can project our own universal feelings of teenage isolation onto this, it doesn't making it strictly a political statement about 1980s Bogota strip away its universal human appeal.
Like it traps it in a specific time and place.
Exactly. If it's just a closed historical document, it loses its power for someone looking at it in, say, 2023 Miami.
I see what you mean. But what's fascinating here is that the silence and the fragmentation aren't just random quirks of an aging brain or generic teenage angst.
Okay, what are they then?
The reality of 1980s Colombia physically forced its citizens to live fragmented, silent lives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so the aesthetic of isolation you see in the painting isn't a metaphor. It is the literal fingerprint of a collective trauma.
The political reality created the psychological reality.
Exactly.
So if this trauma is literal, how does it actually change the physical neighborhood? Because the artist doesn't just paint empty streets.
No, he paints the buildings as if they are hiding from something.
Right. The sources describe the architecture in the watercolor as having a very simple, almost frontal perspective. But it's deliberately compressed.
It pushes back at you.
Yeah, when you look at the composition, the space feels like it's pushing back against you. It is designed to visually slow down transit and force the viewer into a state of introspection.
And the artwork achieves that compression through a distinct lack of deep vanishing points.
Like you can't see far down the road.
Right. In a typical landscape painting, your eye can wander down a long street toward the horizon line, which gives the viewer a visual escape route.
But Duke removes that escape.
Completely. The walls loom, creating this very shallow depth of field.
The analysis describes these buildings as compact and closed blocks.
Yes, but the most devastating detail regarding the architecture is the direct quote from the source describing the windows.
Oh, the windows.
The windows in these homes are described as more defensive than open.
A defensive window? I mean, that is such a loaded tactical phrase for a piece of domestic architecture.
It really is. Because in a peaceful society, a window is designed for light, for airflow, you know, for looking out at your neighbors and connecting with the street.
Right, to see the world.
But in this specific historical era in Bogota, a defensive window is a tactical, physical response to real external threats.
So we are talking about smaller apertures, heavy grating, positioning that prevents anyone from seeing inside.
The community literally had to entrench themselves.
They had to fortify their everyday domestic spaces just to hide from the reality of the streets.
Exactly. You don't look out, because looking out means you can be seen.
Wow. So a house stops being a place to live and basically becomes a bunker.
A bunker, yeah.
And yet, here's where it gets really interesting. The artist himself provides a quote that complicates this bunker idea.
What does he say?
He says that in this painting, the house stops being mere architecture and becomes a witness.
A witness stands there and absorbs the era. It silently testifies to history.
But I'm struggling with that concept in the context of this specific painting.
How so?
Well, witness testifies to cold, hard facts. If Duke's goal was just to testify politically to be a witness, wouldn't the painting feel like a closed historical pamphlet?
Like a rigid textbook diagram.
Yeah, showing exactly how bad the security situation was. But instead, it's blurry. It feels like an open invitation to the viewer to interpret it.
And that's crucial. Because if it were purely a rigid political document, it would risk becoming propaganda, which leaves no room for the viewer to bring their own experiences into it.
Right. So where does that open interpretation come from?
It comes from how the people act within this constrained space. The isolation of those defensive bricks spills over directly onto the human figures in the painting.
Ah, I see. The sources point out the absence of noise and an economy of human gestures among the people in the watercolor.
They were just existing.
Yeah, the figures walk, but they do it without touching. They are described as bodies crossing a space without claiming it.
And this was a literal survival strategy.
Mm-hmm.
The source material uses a striking analogy that explains this perfectly.
Okay, I'm listening.
Imagine you are on the last subway car at 3 a.m. traveling through a highly dangerous neighborhood.
Oof. Okay, yeah.
Think about how everyone behaves in that specific situation. No one makes eye contact.
You keep your limbs close to your body.
You don't make sudden movements. The passengers on that 3 a.m. subway aren't having a philosophical crisis about the isolation of modern life.
They're surviving. They're on high alert.
Exactly. That economy of gestures is a trauma response. And that is the exact society Duke is illustrating in Paul of the Sixth.
So relating to people in public space was inherently dangerous, so you just tried not to leave a footprint.
You move from bunker to bunker as invisibly as possible.
Man, the humans were so paralyzed by fear that they completely surrendered their own public squares.
That's tragic.
It is. But I am stuck on one specific detail in the composition that completely breaks this gritty realism for me.
Which detail?
Amidst all these closed-off buildings and tense, isolated people, there is a discreet silhouette of an animal observing the scene.
Ah, the animal.
Yeah. The source says this animal views the city as if it were outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get this. If he is painting a tactical documentary of neighborhood paranoia, putting a surreal ghost animal in the middle of it feels like a massive contradiction.
It feels sort of like magical realism creeping into a war zone.
Exactly. What is that doing there? Doesn't that prove the artist is aiming for something more metaphysical?
It seems completely out of place at first glance. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, to what happens when a society is battered by violence, the animal actually amplifies the historical gravity.
How does it amplify it?
Well, the concept of a normal public space becomes absurd. The public square is no longer a place for human connection. It's a zone of active threat.
Right, because of the cartels and the violence.
So the humans have essentially become ghosts in their own city. Because the human element has retreated behind defensive windows, only an extra human, a temporal observer, like a stray animal, can stand still out in the open and safely watch.
Oh, wow. So the animal's freedom highlights the absence of human freedom.
Precisely.
The humans are so alienated that the only free living things in the city are the strays.
It's a really chilling detail when you realize what it represents.
It really is. Okay, so we've dug deep into the imagery, the defensive windows, the isolated figures, the surreal animal. But the sources spent a massive amount of time breaking down the physical materials used to create the artwork.
Literally the paper and the paint.
Yeah, which seems so technical, but it's fascinating.
It's the materiality of the memory.
Yeah.
The medium itself is part of the message.
So Duke didn't just grab a standard canvas or a smooth sheet of poster board. He used Daniel Smith brand watercolors on a very specific type of paper.
640-gram cold-pressed Arches paper.
Exactly. Let's break down why this matters to you listening, because a 640-gram paper is essentially woven cotton.
It is incredibly thick, rigid, almost like cardboard.
Yeah, and being cold-pressed means it was pressed through felt rollers without heat during manufacturing, which leaves this heavy, pronounced grain.
The surface is covered in microscopic divots and bumps.
Right, so what happens when you paint on that?
Well, when you apply watercolor to a smooth surface, the pigment glides. It allows for sharp edges, crisp architectural lines, and high-definition details.
But when watercolor hits a 640-gram cold-pressed grain,
the heavy pigment particles physically get trapped in those deep divots. The paper actively fights the brush.
It fights the brush. So the texture physically breaks the sharpness of the line.
You cannot paint a perfect crisp building on this paper, even if you wanted to.
It creates what the sources call visual noise.
Like static.
Yeah, think of the static on an old tube television set. Duke combines this static texture with a very specific color palette, too.
Lots of muted grays, dull ochres, and washed-out blues.
And when you put that trapped pigment together with those desaturated colors, it physically creates a foggy atmosphere.
It manufactures the literal texture of emotional distance.
The technique itself is shouting that this is an evocation, not a high-definition photograph.
And that visual noise is fascinating because the artist ties this physical technique directly back to the 1980s context.
Oh, the quote about the cold, right?
Yes. Duke says the cold is not only climatic, it is also historical and emotional.
Historical and emotional.
And he uses a term in the original Spanish materials, anímico, that translates roughly to a coldness of the soul or the spirit.
Climatic, historical, and a coldness of the spirit.
So this texture, the visual noise, the trapped pigment, the muted color, isn't just the natural blur of a memory degrading over 40 years.
It's intentional.
It is the physical, material representation of an oppressive political era. It's an emotional smog that suffocated the entire society.
Emotional smog?
Yeah, the climate of the painting wraps the closed buildings and the isolated people in the exact same blanket of paralysis.
So the cold of the history froze the spirit of the people. And you can actually see that freezing and how the paint pools and gets stuck in the heavy paper.
The trauma is quite literally baked into the fibers of the artwork.
That is just incredible. So we've been pulling on these two distinct threads for this entire deep dive. On the one hand, we have this triumph of introspection, a beautiful, blurry map of universal youth isolation that anyone listening could project their own teenage loneliness onto.
Right, the psychological landscape.
And on the other hand, we have an encrypted historical document, a tactical map of defensive windows dictated by the terror of 1980s Colombia.
The socio-political reality.
So what does this all mean when we finally weave them together?
Well, the conclusion the sources lead us to is that separating the intimate from the historical is basically an impossible task.
They can't be untangled.
No, they can't. The artwork's entire power comes from this exact duality. The artist, sitting in his peaceful studio in California in 2023, is painting from a psyche that was permanently molded by the defensive bricks of his neighborhood in the 1980s.
You cannot translate the soul of a memory without showing the scars that history left on the physical space.
Exactly. The macro history of an entire nation in turmoil and the micro history of a single adolescent boy feeling isolated are literally the exact same story.
They merge on that thick, grainy paper.
They absolutely do.
I mean, think about the spaces you inhabit right now. When a society's social fabric tears, when there is a latent fear in the air, it doesn't just dictate how people interact on the streets.
It doesn't just make you keep your head down on the subway.
Right, or avoid eye contact on the sidewalk. It dictates how the windows of a home are designed. It dictates the architecture of where you sleep.
The internal feeling of alienation is inextricably linked to the external historical threat.
You build walls around your mind because the world forced you to build walls around your living room.
It's a profound testament to how porous the boundary is between the world outside and the mind inside.
It really is.
Which brings me to a thought I'd like to leave you with, something to mull over when this deep dive is done.
Go for it.
Because the artwork is so open, it invites us to turn that lens on ourselves. Tonight, when you close your eyes and you picture the facade of your own childhood home, that impregnable fortress we talked about at the very beginning, ask yourself something.
What's that?
Are you really seeing the place exactly as it was? Or are you seeing the emotional architecture of what the outside world forced you to become? Are the walls you remember made of wood and brick? Or are they made of the fears and the hopes of the era you grew up in?
Wow. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the sources today. It's been an incredible journey unpacking the intersection of memory, art, and history. We encourage you to keep exploring how your own history shapes the way you see the world. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.